Offline is brought to you by Quince. As the weather cools, I'm swapping in the pieces that actually get the job done. Warm, durable, and built to last. And Quince delivers every time with wardrobe staples that'll carry you through the season. Quince has the kind of fall staples you'll actually want to wear on repeat, like 100% Mongolian cashmere from just $60, classic fit denim, and real leather and wool outerwear that looks sharp and holds up. They got this great suede trucker jacket now, perfect for layering and just looks really casual but put together, which, of course, that's what everyone wants. You want to look casual but also put together.
Damn right.
By partnering directly with ethical factories and top artisans, Quince cuts out the middlemen to deliver premium quality at half the cost of similar brands. Just went on the website the other day, got some stuff, got one of those sweaters, really great. Also got one of their sweatshirts, super comfortable, very affordable. Go check it out. Layer up this fall with pieces that feel as good as they look. Go to quince.com/offline for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/offline. Free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/offline.
When they're recruiting candidates, they are looking for number one thing. Can they raise the money? Which is, are they personally rich? Do they have rich friends? Number two is bio, resume, basically, you know, high name recognition because, you know, they're a sitting elected statewide person, or they were a Marine and a Rhodes Scholar and they, you know, now they're a neurosurgeon, whatever. Are they good at talking to people? Are they good at getting attention? Do they have riz? That actually doesn't rate that high in the candidate recruitment playbook. And so part of this, too, is about thinking about candidates in a little bit of a different way, because those staffers are probably correct that some of the people that have been recruited, you don't want going 2 hours unscripted in a podcast.
I'm Jon Favreau, and you just heard from friend of the pod, Chris Hayes, the host of MSNBC's All In with Chris Hayes and the author of many books, including his latest, The Siren's Call, which he talked about last time he was here. The Siren's Call is about our attention, why the competition for it has become so fierce, and the implications of that dynamic for just about everything. This week, Chris wrote a piece about attention for the New York Times that caught my eye, because it's about why Democrats have been losing the war for people's attention and how they might be able to change that. This is something I've been thinking about and talking about quite a bit, especially since 2024. And I've become especially frustrated with party leadership for not making it a higher priority to find and support candidates who have an aptitude for communicating and connecting with people in a way that gets and holds their attention. Sounds obvious, and yet, here we are. Anyway, Chris and I get into all of it. Lessons from 2024, Trump, Mamdani, Obama, AOC, and of course, the Graham Platner drama. Spoiler, we solved everything. And just a heads up, you may have noticed that this episode came out on Saturday morning, which is our new and hopefully permanent time slot. We figured we'd give you all weekend to listen to the show while you're hopefully resting, walking, and not looking at your phone, except to find this podcast, of course. Okay, now for my conversation with Chris Hayes. Chris, welcome back.
It's great to be back.
Last time you were on, we talked about your outstanding book on attention, Siren's Call. Still one of my favorite books this year.
Thank you.
Also, apparently Barack Obama's.
Barack Obama also liked it, which was pretty awesome. That I will say, that was pretty cool. I loved, this year he made an addition to his picks list where he had like little handwritten reviews, but I was digging it.
Putting a lot of time into something.
My phone blew up. Yeah, that was cool.
So this time I wanted to talk to you about a piece you wrote for the New York Times this week. Is part of a series they're doing on the future of the Democratic Party. So your piece is also about attention, but in the specific context of why Democrats need to focus on getting more of it. You start by arguing that Kamala Harris's, quote, core problem was not her message, however imperfect it might have been. It was an inability to get enough people to hear it. Maybe you can start by making the case as to why you think Harris's message was less of a problem than her getting attention.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to ground analysis of what went wrong in 2024 in the results, right? And one of the things you saw was the swing towards Trump in uncontested states. There's effectively no campaign. There's no local ad buys. There's no local events. Was larger, and sometimes really considerably larger, than the swing towards Trump in the swing states where there was a campaign, which is to say, take away the campaigns and the attentional information environment plus inflation and the just state of the country was pushing towards Trump, and the campaign in the states that it was spending $2 billion actually seems to be fairly effective in moving that back a few points.
Yeah.
I think it's important to recognize that, because I think it so much can be chalked up to the campaign, but like, why was New Jersey, New York, and California these enormous swings to Donald Trump? And that's where they weren't, no one saw any Kamala Harris ads, right? No one saw the candidate. So my point is, yes, I think the arguments about both the issues Democrats stand for, the coalition and the big tent, the message are all really important and useful. But one of the big takeaways, I think, from the campaign is, from 2024 is, unless people are hearing that message, unless you're somehow breaking through, the message is not going to matter that much. And that is an enormous thing for not just national candidates to figure out, but I think from president down to basically the congressional level, everyone's got to have a theory of attention.
This is obviously tough to unpack, but I want to try to do it, which is like, you could also argue, though, that if the message itself had been more compelling, even in the swing states, then more people would have spread it, shared it.
Yes.
More people would have heard it. So like, I always try to figure out how to figure out the interplay between the message itself and like,
yes,
what actually generates attention. Isn't it the message itself that generates attention, or lack thereof?
So that's a good point. What I'm trying to talk about here, and I think it's useful to talk about this distinction between what we call paid and earned media, right? So in campaigns, these two categories. Paid media is the ads you buy, mailers, radio ads, and mostly television. Earned media is the interviews you give and the media events you do. Press conferences, you do campaign events. Let's just talk for a moment about paid media. And I think you'll agree with this, although I'm curious to hear how you see it as someone who has worked in the trenches. I don't think people outside politics understand how much, for the last 20 or 30 or 40 years, what campaigning is: raising a ton of money and spending that money on TV ads. In the same way that Paul Krugman once said the U.S. government is like a social insurance program with an army attached, and like, because basically our large entitlement programs and Defense Department are like, you know, 85% of the budget, a campaign is a vehicle to purchase TV ads. And so what that means is that exists because the TV ad solves an attentional problem. How do you get people's attention? I'm running for office. How do you know about it? I buy TV ads. And one of the points that I'm making in the piece is that model really worked pretty well. It's just degrading. And because it's degrading, you have to be thinking about how are you reaching people that aren't seeing your ads, which if you're buying them on local news, right, on networks, is a larger and larger share of the electorate, particularly young people. So go back to your point, I think the paid ads were pretty good. They tended to be, I think, pretty effective. The earned media, the strategy to get that message out into the ecosystem more broadly, I think was deficient.
There is an implication in talking about the sort of like how paid media is not as effective as it once was, which is, and you say this in the piece, and I think this might surprise a lot of people, especially people who follow politics closely, which is that money cannot buy attention as reliably or directly as it once could. And I think the implications there, you know, are, it means that fundraising in this new world might not be as important. It could mitigate some of the damage that Citizens United has unleashed on our campaign finance system, or at least even the playing field for candidates who don't have a lot of money but do have a lot of aptitude for getting attention.
Yes, I think all of those things are true. I think it remains to be seen how this all plays out. So we're sort of at a strange hinge point, right? Lots of people still watch TV. There's this sort of tendency to kind of overread the death of television. I know this because I work in television and I still have a TV show and I talk to 5 million people a week. Like there's people watching. So, but clearly it's changing profoundly and the old model's coming apart. And so the question becomes, I think you'll see two things. One is, I think you're going to start to see ads crop up in a lot of other places, right? So if the streaming services start doing more and more ads, well, then if you can geo-target in a congressional district to the people who are on Netflix, particularly if you can kind of demographically model who's probably a swing voter, or you can even better buy that data, right? That's a huge new area we might start to see. We might start to see more ads on TikTok. So there are ways in which the paid ad world might adapt to these changes. But I also think that first point you made, which is if you're good at getting attention in earned media through all sorts of different ways, right? Vertical video like Zora Mamdani, TikTok as Jeff Jackson did down in North Carolina, you have avenues to reach people that you didn't have before, and that also sidestep, you know, some of the obstacles you might have faced previously.
I have a take on this that is unsupported in the sense that I haven't been involved in a campaign for quite some time now, since 2012. But like, I just think that paid media as a whole is just so much less effective. Forget about where you're reaching people. Forget about television versus your banner ads versus your TikTok ads. It feels to me that in this information environment, where we are now, especially younger generations, so used to just watching content with people who are just authentic and themselves and a little rough around the edges, that the typical paid media ad, whether you're seeing it on television, whether you're seeing it on your screen or your phone, it's just, I can't imagine that it is as effective as earned media appearances. Like, I'd rather put my candidate on your show talking to you and reach the people that you reach than buy an ad on your show for my candidate. And like, if I had to pick one, right?
I totally agree. B, I absolutely share your intuition here. I want to be humble and say, I don't know how testable the hypothesis is and what the data say. So I do want to be humble about this. One thing that I think, though, that I write about in the piece, and I think you'll agree with, is to go back to that thought experiment. Do I want to book my candidate on Chris's show, or do I want to buy a 30-second spot? If you buy a 30-second spot, the downside risk of a screw-up is very low. You tape the ad, you're in an edit room,
yeah.
You make sure that every little thing, and occasionally you screw up ads, as people know. Stuff gets in there, someone looks kind of silly, it doesn't land the way you think, but you have this control. Also, there's an industry of people that get paid for purchasing those ads.
I was about to say that.
Who have a direct financial incentive in buying ad time. If you put a candidate on my show or any show or long-form podcast, like, things can go sideways. They can give an answer that then gets magnified. You can have a moment where you don't look great. And I think this is true of all political professionals, but particularly in the Democratic Party, there is a very intense risk aversion. Waltz compared it to playing prevent defense, was how he talked about the campaign, which is in football, like,
yeah,
you're sort of hanging back. You don't want to give up any long touchdown passes, so you let a lot of little things happen in front of you. And I think there's a very similar kind of mentality through much of the political staff culture in Democratic circles.
100%. And I think a lot of it stems from not fully trusting the candidate. When you have a when you have a candidate, you can trust.
Messages from people in response to this to say, "Yeah, buddy, it's like, you sure you want to uncork some of the people I've worked for?" And my response to that, which I would like to hear your take on, is it goes down to the level of candidate recruitment. To come back to this model that dominates politics, and I really can't emphasize enough, when they're recruiting candidates, they are looking for number one thing: can they raise the money? Which is, are they personally rich? Do they have rich friends? Do they have a bank account? Number two is bio, resume, basically. High name recognition because, you know, they're a sitting elected statewide person. Or they've got a great story. They were a Marine and a Rhodes Scholar and now they're a neurosurgeon, whatever. Are they good at talking to people? Are they good at getting attention? Do they have riz? That actually doesn't rate that high in the candidate recruitment playbook. And so part of this, too, is about thinking about candidates in a little bit of a different way, because those staffers are probably correct that some of the people that have been recruited, you don't want going 2 hours unscripted in a podcast.
Offline is brought to you by Smalls. Does your cat have gut issues? Maybe it's time for a diet upgrade with Smalls. For a limited time, get 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/offline. Smalls cat food is protein-packed recipes made with preservative-free ingredients you'd find in your fridge, and it's delivered right to your door. That's why cats.com named Smalls their best overall cat food. Starting with Smalls is easy. Just share info about your cat's diet, health, and food preferences. Then Smalls puts together a personalized sampler for your cat. No more picking between random brands at the store. Smalls has the right food to satisfy any cat's cravings. Here's a review from a real Smalls customer. Jennifer M. said, after every feeding, he gets this burst of energy and starts running around the house. And his fur is softer and more vibrant with higher contrast. Honestly, I wouldn't recommend anything else. It's actually about Tommy. Smalls works with the Humane World for Animals. Through the Humane World for Animals, they've donated over $1 million worth of food to help cats, and they even give you a chance to donate at checkout, whether you donate $5 for flea and tick medications or $7 for vaccines. After switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements. That's a big deal. The team at Smalls is so confident your cat will love their product that you can try it risk-free. That means they'll refund you if your cat won't eat their food. What are you waiting for? Give your cat the food they deserve for a limited time because you're an offline listener. Get 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/offline. One last time, that's 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/offline.
Are you concerned about microplastics in your home? Blue Land makes it easy to make sustainable choices. Blue Land cleaning sprays, toilet bowl cleaner, and dishwasher and laundry detergent tablets are free from dyes, parabens, and harsh chemicals. Blue Land is a certified B Corp and Leaping Bunny cruelty-free certified. Their formulas are EPA Safer Choice certified, and many products have also earned Cradle to Cradle's Gold Material Health Certificate. Get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/crooked. blueland.com/crooked.
I would say, along with resume and bio, there's other qualification, which is, do your politics and your issue positions and your ideology match the voters in your district, in your state? And I think this is where the DSCC, the DCCC especially are like, and we're, you know, we'll talk about this, them putting their thumbs on the scales of primaries left and right here, but they want a candidate who can win. And of course, ability to raise money, good bio, but also like politics that aren't too left, really, is the sometimes too right, but mostly too left.
Totally agree with that. Although the one thing I would say is it tends to be the case that those first two do a lot of that job.
Yeah, that is true.
You know what I mean? It's like, if you're going out to this swing district in Kansas and you want someone, like, are you going to find someone with like a huge fundraising circle and like a sterling bio who's also like a hardcore socialist? Like, probably not. So... But you're right, of course. And I look, no shade on that. Like, I want to be very clear. Like, you could not run Zora Mamdani in Sharice David's district in Kansas and expect to win. You would lose by 25 points, at least, right? Like, this is real. And you should 100% be sensitive to that. But I also think that, like, that fundraising thing really, I just think it's always so striking to me as a person who talks for a living. The wide delta of the ability to talk in professional politicians.
I don't understand it. Like, I really don't. And I don't know. I mean, this, I was going to ask you, like, I can't tell if it is a supply problem or it is a, like a recruitment issue, right? Like, if you talk to the people who are recruiting these candidates, would they just tell you, well, this is who we got and we can't find really good talkers out there who are normal human beings who don't sound like robots when they and spitting out talking points. Like, we just can't find them. They're not signing up. Or are they just not, they just don't care about it, right? Like, I can't tell.
I can't tell either. And then on top of that, there's also that people who are good talkers get kind of trained into being very talking point machine, you know, cautious. I mean, look, I really think the fundraising thing is a big part of it. Because I just think if you go into a district and you think, like, who can raise $2 million? Like, how many people are there anywhere that could raise $2 million? It's not a lot of people, if that's how you start thinking about people. And that really is the first threshold for all of these races. And so I think that has a huge effect on who you end up with. I mean, look, McConnell has used this method. This isn't just a Democratic thing. McConnell's used this method, and he's, you know, he's run some real lemons out there. I mean,
yes.
Hovde in Wisconsin, which is a totally winnable seat. It's like, that guy had the bio, he had the money personally, he's a rich dude, and he has the fundraising, and he had the politics, basically. That was it. He was not a particularly great candidate because he was not recruited to be a guy who could talk compellingly about his vision for the country.
The other challenge within the Democratic Party on this is, so there's at the staff level, people being worried that they can't send their candidate into a two-hour podcast. You also, and this is a tough one to tease out, but like you also hear from consultants who make the ads and who then test the ads. So they're in the polling and they do the ads and they're buying the ads and they get a cut of the ads. So there's a self-interest there. And you hear from them that like, this is very important, that paid ads are still important, that things are changing, but that they're still really effective. And I don't want to dismiss that judgment just based on the fact that there is some self-interest there, because both could be true. But I've seen this forever. And a lot of these people are like, you know, friends of mine, people I've worked with. But you're sort of like, I don't know. It is a little bit more art than just science in determining whether an ad is an effective way to move a voter.
Yes, there's a lot of both. And this is the thing about politics always, right? Like, it's always art and science. It's always data and gut. There are people who can create new models and formulas that didn't exist before that you couldn't reverse engineer. And then everyone comes along and it's like, okay, now vertical video is a thing. Like, we'll all do vertical video, right? And part of that is useful evolution. The other thing that I think about the risk calculus, right? Because I do think that A, paid ads are still effective in many respects. And I think there's evidence for that. But I do think the risk factor is a huge part of it. And one of the things I think is really important to think about is it really matters the context of whether you think you're winning a race or losing a race. Like, in the same way, to go back to the football metaphor, yeah, like if you're up by 3 touchdowns with 3 minutes left, you should absolutely run the ball and not take a lot of risks. If you're down 3 touchdowns, you got to throw the ball. And there's a lot of confusion, I think. I think sometimes this is the polling. Like, are we down or up? What, you know? And I think, you know, if you go back to that main race in 2020 with Sarah Gideon, I think was the candidate against Susan Collins.
Yeah.
Look, the polling had her up like 8 points at some point.
Yeah.
That was never true. It wasn't like she was up and then she lost. The measurement was wrong. And the measurement being wrong means you take a strategy that's also wrong. If you're up 8, you're doing something very different than if you're down 3. And if you're down 3 against an incumbent who has shown her ability to win in that state over and over, you got to take some swings. You got to throw the ball down the field. You got to take some risk. And that, to me, is a huge part of this as well.
But it's like an old political cliche that you're always supposed to run like you're 10 points down.
Right. That's true. Yes.
I mean, maybe it's old and no longer a cliche because maybe people aren't doing that anymore. But I also wonder if, I mean, the Gideon example is interesting. I wonder if because so many races are so close and within a couple points of each other, and the internal polling might show that as well, that causes some of the confusion about whether you're up or down. Right. Yeah. Like, I think if the Harris campaign was looking at all the swing states and they're like, okay, we're up by 1 or 2 in Pennsylvania and the blue wall states, we're down 1 or 2. And, you know, so maybe a risk would be bad because it could blow this 1-point lead we have that might just be enough. Right.
Yeah.
Now, I think if you have the mentality, no, we're 5 points down all the time and we should take a risk, then that's great. But I also understand.
I totally understand.
In the Trump era, the level of, oh gosh, do we want to take a risk? Because the consequence of taking a risk that doesn't work is what we're living through right now. So I think there has been extra caution added to Democratic Party staff and consultants in the era of Donald Trump because the stakes are so big.
I think that's totally true. And I also think that you end up in a situation where, because of that, and because there's sort of this war between usually different factions about within a campaign, as I think you would agree, right? Mm-hmm. People have different views on stuff. You know, one of the things you can get trapped doing is the less media you're doing, the less you are out there, the more amplified every individual hit is. Mm. And the more possibility there is for some gaffe to go viral or to get a lot of attention.
Totally.
Which then confirms the fears of the people who are urging fewer appearances. Whereas, if you say something and then the next day you do five more interviews and the day after that you do five more and you do five more and you get asked about it a bunch and you wipe it away or whatever, the stuff just comes out. No one can remember anything anymore.
Which is a really important point.
It is. And it's like when we think about the Howard Dean scream, which is the kind of iconic viral moment that wasn't even anything. He didn't say anything wrong. He didn't do anything wrong. There was literally nothing morally, politically, substantively objectionable at all about the way his voice sounded for 4 seconds on an overdriven microphone.
Yeah. And it was like ended the campaign.
And it was like looped and it was all, nothing sticks like that anymore. And I do think that that's something that the right has internalized a little more than the left has, particularly because Donald Trump is just so sociopathic and like has no remorse. So everyone sort of just felt like, yeah, doesn't matter.
This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform designed to elevate your online presence and drive your success. Squarespace provides all the tools you need to promote and get paid for your services in one platform. Create a professional website to showcase your offerings and attract clients. Whether you offer consultations, events, or other experiences, Squarespace can help you grow your business. Squarespace offers a complete library of professionally designed and award-winning website templates with options for every use and category. No matter where you start, your website is flexible to what you need with intuitive drag-and-drop editing, beautiful styling options, unrivaled visual design effects, on-brand AI content, and more ways to list what you offer, no experience required. Every dream needs a domain. Squarespace Domain makes it easy to find the best name for your business at one fair, all-inclusive price, no hidden fees or add-ons required. Every Squarespace domain comes with advanced privacy and security tools included to ensure your domain remains online and protected. Plus, Squarespace provides everything you need to bring more of your dream to life, whether that means building a website or adding a professional email service. Don't wait to claim your name. Invest in your dream domain today. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/offline to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/offline.
Are you concerned about microplastics in your home? Blue Land makes it easy to make sustainable choices. Blue Land cleaning sprays, toilet bowl cleaner, and dishwasher and laundry detergent tablets are free from dyes, parabens, and harsh chemicals. Blue Land is a certified B Corp and Leaping Bunny cruelty-free certified. Their formulas are EPA Safer Choice certified, and many products have also earned Cradle to Cradle's Gold Material Health Certificate. Get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/crooked. blueland.com/crooked.
Why do you think Donald Trump is so effective at getting attention? What's the formula?
I mean, I think he has a kind of feral pathological need for it that's like not replicable.
Mm, that's what I was going to ask, if you think it's replicable.
It's like, why was Napoleon so driven? You know, it's like, I think his psychological brokenness combined with, and this I think actually is applicable, coming up in 1980s New York City tabloids. Mm. Which was an incredibly competitive media environment. In fact, when you saw Curtis Sliwa on the debate stage, if you were watching the New York mayoral elections, I think people had to admit, like, wow, this guy's good at grabbing and keeping attention. And I'm like, they came up in the same milieu. Literally, when I grew up in New York City, two of the people most likely to be on the wood, as they called it, at the bus stop in the tabloids was Curtis Sliwa and Donald Trump, man. Like, these are creatures of a very particular attentional environment that is now all of our environment all the time.
Yeah.
It was very weird back then because it was very competitive. You had three different daily tabloids. You were fighting for attention among them. Big controversy, polemics, negative attention got people's attention, and you could sort of trade off that. So I think he honed his skill in this particular environment that just happens to be very good for what we now live.
I have this theory that it's much easier to get attention when you're willing to set yourself on fire every day. Like if you're going, people would pay attention to that. It would not necessarily be good for you.
Yeah.
It would not necessarily be effective in trying to win a race. But Donald Trump is willing to do that, right? And he is willing to sort of take on the negative attention as well.
Yep.
But I do think that it is especially harder for Democrats because I think the kind of content that is most likely to go viral today and grab our attention, right, is content that makes us angry, afraid, more polarized. It tends to be sensational, gossipy, dramatic, not a lot of nuance, not a lot of gray. And it's basically everything that is antithetical to a functioning democracy. And so I've always wondered if it makes it especially difficult for the pro-democracy party to break through without sort of undermining their political beliefs and political goals.
It's a really great question. And it gets to a foundational question, which I sort of touch on in the book, but never quite come out and answer, which is the current attention marketplace like structurally reactionary?
Yes.
Right? Like, is it the case that in highly competitive attention markets, what outcompetes are lurid, base, rage-filled kinds of bait? And I think the answer is kind of yes. So I do think that, for instance, the evening news is structurally reactionary when it comes to crime.
Yeah. Has been for, and local news especially.
That's what I mean. I'm saying local evening news is structured. Now, that's not to say that there are amazing crime reports. Like, these are people that I have known and respected. No one's doing anything wrong individually. It is a news story if someone in your city is shot and killed. And in fact, the survivors of that and the victims deserve that acknowledgement. But in the aggregate, right? Like, what it does is it produces a kind of reactionary mindset. So part of that is the problem, yes. Algorithmic social media, competitive attention marketplaces, they look like Times Square casinos and tabloid checkout counters. That's what they are.
That's right? Donald Trump right there. Yeah.
And that's what Donald Trump is. But I will say this. I do think, like the Jeff Jackson example that I give in the piece, people talk a lot about AOC and Mamdani and, you know, the left, Joe Rogan. Jackson's a really interesting case because this guy is a sort of center-left Democrat. His politics are not super left in any way. And the way that he started going viral on TikTok was just like explaining to his constituents what they were doing. Like, here's what we're doing in Congress today. We got this vote and we got to take that vote before we do this vote. And it was just like plain spoken and really effective. And I do think, to your point of like, that to me was going viral in a way that was not all of the worst impulses, lowest common denominator. And what I do think is people got to try stuff to discover what's out there. And the Mamdani innovation of being the interviewer was a brilliant innovation. Brilliant. That's a new thing. I'd never seen a candidate do that before. I have never seen a candidate interview people on camera. Brilliant. I'd never seen someone explain congressional procedure and what their day was like Jeff Jackson did. Like, you got to try new stuff. There might be stuff that does work in this format and that also isn't rage bait.
Yeah, I also think humor works to get attention if you can pull it off.
I mean, that's Trump's secret weapon. It's why when Carrie Lake or other people try to pull it off, it doesn't work because they're humorless. DeSantis.
I think on our side, inspiration can work too, even though, you know, it's a much more cynical time, so that's tricky. You have some advice for Democrats in the piece. Just going to go through some of them. Go everywhere, right? We sort of talked about this with Harris. I do wonder, though, like, isn't it weird that you have, you know, you talked about in the piece, AOC, Mamdani, you brought up Jeff Jackson. I could probably count on two hands how many Democrats I would feel comfortable putting on Rogan, right? Like, and I'm not the cautious staffer. I think that people need to take risks. But I sort of wondered about that after the whole Kamala Harris Rogan story came out, because I'm like, okay, they did try, it didn't work. Could she have tried harder, and could they have moved the schedule? Yes, they could have. But then I was like, how would that have gone?
Yeah, that's a fair question. James Tallarico, I will give a shout out to the Texas state senator who's running for Senate in Texas, who did go on Rogan and acquitted himself very well.
If you're worried about your candidate and you don't know that they can go on Rogan, do you send them on anyway? Like, is it better to go and really do the question. 2 hours that might be a little rough and then that's what people remember? Or is it like, no, I'm going to find something else?
I think that really depends on who the candidate is. It really does. And how good they are at talking in that setting. But it's also a little bit of a reps thing. For instance, it's interesting. I do a lot of public speaking, but I'm never giving speeches. And I don't think in my life I've ever given a political speech. And one of the things I've noticed is I'm a pretty good talker and I'm pretty good at speaking, but I can't do that thing that really good politicians do, which is like crescendo and like get to the end and like the audience gets up and swells. And that's a particular skill. If I were running for office and I got the reps in, I think I would be able to do that. Mm. So it is a kind of a reps thing.
That is very true. David Axelrod would always say this about Obama, that when he was a state senator traveling around Illinois, he was not the guy who appeared on the stage in 2004 at the convention and gave that speech. And in fact, gave pretty lengthy, sometimes quite wonky, speeches and learn to be a really good speaker.
I don't know if you've ever read the Chicago Reader coverage of the Bobby Rush primary, which is just like, it's just like this like nerd professor doofus like showing up.
This is Obama we're talking about.
Obama challenging incumbent former Black Panther, sort of beloved iconic figure on the South Side, Bobby Rush, and basically getting his ass handed to him. And that really, those contemporaneous accounts of him losing that primary really speaks to the fact that like he got better and he got better at doing specific things. So I think part of it is if part of what the Times demand is just talking a lot to people, then you got to both recruit candidates to do it, but also they got to do it a lot to get better at doing it.
Yeah. The reps thing is important. And you know, one of your pieces of advice is always be posting. Of course, absolutely.
Yeah, right.
And you note that one thing successful content creators will tell you about excelling in the world of digital attention is that there's no penalty for quantity.
No one's keeping a batting average.
Which is true.
Sadly. I mean, I kind of wish we lived in a world in which everyone did less and tried to make it better. I say this as like a cable news host.
But this is my question. Is like, I do wonder if like a level of basic quality control is necessary, especially when you're putting out that much content. Because I always think of like the people who are only casually consuming political news, and if the moment that they tune in and look at their phone, you have some fucking terribly cringy post or a video clip where you know a politician sounds like they were trained on the a Democratic consultant version of ChatGPT, then you might be like, I'm done. I'm not coming back to this. But like, I don't know. Who knows? Maybe then, you know, then Chuck Schumer shows up in your phone again and it's better than the last time. And maybe you change your mind. I don't know.
Right. I mean, I think that does go back to this idea of how long does the impression last if you're not constantly creating new stuff? I mean, Vance was really interesting to me, right? Because Vance is a fairly able talker. He's quite smooth. But I also think is kind of charmless. It certainly doesn't have the kind of strange charisma that Trump has. He also just gave a ton of interviews during that Ohio primary, right? Which was like, again, when people talk about the groups and the groups were the ones that killed off Kamala and because she took position in the primary— all of the really problematic things that Vance said and the people he spoke to were in the context where he was like vying with a bunch of other complete right-wing fringe figures to win the Republican primary. And it did come back to bite him, like the cat lady thing and the giving the interview with the guy who thinks that the age of consent is too high and, you know, on and on and on.
Yeah.
Even as these sentences come out of my mouth, right? It's like, Right.
This is the world we're living in.
Yeah. This is the world we're living in, right? The guy who thinks. And I just think he overcame it by just like talking so much. It just kind of got buried under quantity a little bit, right? Don't you feel like that was the case?
I do. And I wonder if he is making up for the lack of charisma now by just being in everyone's face all the time, which is what he learned from Donald Trump. And like,
yes,
we sort of all make fun of him for like shit posting all the time. He's just tweeting. He's tweeting at me, he's tweeting at all of us all the time. And it's like, maybe that's helpful in the long run. I can't tell, because maybe people are like, okay, well, he's, you know, he's at least responding to questions. He's out there. He's on Twitter. He's on TV. He's given interviews. I can't tell if that will make up for the clear lack of charisma, at least in relation to Donald Trump that he has. But it is certainly, it's worth thinking about.
Yeah. And I wonder also how, I mean, whenever you're talking about this, there's a few caveats too, right? Like, none of these rules are universal. I mean, one thing you can always point to is like, look at Roy Cooper, right, in North Carolina. Like, you know, Roy Cooper is perfectly good at talking, but he is a very traditional old school politician.
Yes.
He's careful with his words. He's not doing a ton of viral stuff. He's not courting negative attention. He was a very popular two-term governor, Democratic governor of the state of North Carolina, where he won in really difficult terrain, you know, consecutive elections, and managed to pass the baton to a third straight Democratic governor. That is a huge thing. He left with very high approval ratings, and he doesn't do anything that I'm talking about here.
Right.
So there's not one model. The other thing I would also say is that I really think the stuff that I say about attention stops working below a certain level of district. Mm. A friend of mine and I were talking about this, whose spouse is actually a state legislator. You can't win a city council race by going viral. Like, it just, the way the algorithm works is not geolocated enough. It doesn't work that way. You have to go knock doors and send mail. And so, like, there's a theory of attention for how you get people to know that you're running in a local race, state rep, state senate, city council, school board, that's like, shake hands at morning drop-off, send out four pieces of mail, hit the doors of your staff and your volunteers. That still works. And if you think you're going to, like, game that online, like, I really think that's not going to work.
Yeah. And also, I'm fascinated to see how Roy Cooper does running a national race, statewide, but national.
Yeah.
In this media environment.
Yeah.
Because I think that if he does well, I think that's a very good data point that would make me rethink at least some of the attentional dynamics.
It does. Although the one thing that I would say about that is, in the same way it matters, right? Are you winning or are you losing about how you know, what your strategy is? If you have 100% name recognition among your voters, you're just in a different attentional environment, what you need from them.
Yeah.
If you're trying to take on an incumbent, if you're Graham Plattner or, you know, or whoever, it's like, how does anyone know he's running? This guy was the governor for 8 years. So he just has a very different mission. And you know, to Schumer's credit, I think that's one of the things they look for, right? Like, that's a good recruit. I don't think anyone could possibly second guess Roy Cooper.
Offline is brought to you by Bookshop.org, where you shop for books matters. When you purchase from Bookshop.org, you're supporting more than 2,500 local independent bookstores across the country. Independent bookstores do more than sell books. They take care of and pour back into their communities, creating safe spaces that foster culture, curiosity, and a love of reading. Whether you're searching for an incisive history that helps you make sense of this moment, a novel that sweeps you away, or the perfect gift for a loved one, Bookshop.org has you covered. Now you can support local independent bookstores even when you read digitally with Bookshop.org's ebook app. You can browse and purchase on Bookshop.org and read right in your device's web browser or the full reading experience. Or for the full reading experience, download the app for iPhone or Android. Every purchase financially supports local independent bookstores. We love Bookshop.org. Have an independent bookstore right by me called Chevalier's Bookstore, one of the oldest in Los Angeles.
Great people.
And, you know, you go to Bookshop.org, you probably have a favorite independent bookstore too. You're helping support it. So check it out. Use code OFFLINE10 to get 10% off your next order at Bookshop.org. That's code OFFLINE10 at Bookshop.org.
Are you concerned about microplastics in your home? Blue Land makes it easy to make sustainable choices. Blue Land cleaning sprays, toilet bowl cleaner, and dishwasher and laundry detergent tablets are free from dyes, parabens, and harsh chemicals. Blue Land is a certified B Corp and Leaping Bunny cruelty-free certified. Their formulas are EPA Safer Choice certified, and many products have also earned Cradle to Cradle's Gold Material Health Certificate. Get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/crooked. blueland.com/crooked.
You mentioned Mamdani and those videos and him interviewing people. Why do you think that worked? Like from an attentional standpoint, like I've been wondering that myself because it's unique. I hadn't seen it before. It is very watchable. He seems very reasonable. He seems genuinely curious talking to the people that he's interviewing. I don't know.
One, he has charisma. You know, he's a charismatic dude. And that's a huge part of why it worked. Two, they're very well done. The videos, like they're like technically, they are quite assured. They do not feel schlocky. They feel tight. So there's some real craftspeople working on those. And then three, that first one, which is the first time that I knew there was this Democratic Socialist Assemblyman in the what's sort of tongue-in-cheek called the commie corridor in New York City, which is a certain section of northern Brooklyn and Queens where, you know, a lot of sort of DSA activism and,
a lot
and
of beards,
electoral
yeah.
success has come out of. Yeah. I sort of generally knew, but I don't think I even knew what he looked like. And then that video where he goes to two different districts, one in the Queens and one in Bronx, actually in Fordham Road, which had two of the biggest pro-Trump swings in 2024 to talk to people about it, it perfectly grabbed the zeitgeist. And the fact that he was not front and center, but other people were,
yeah,
was so smart, but also super manipulative. Because I watched the video and then it was like, okay, well, this is interesting. And then it's like, oh, I'm running. You're like, well, wait a second. What interviews did you edit out? Like, I was like, oh, this is just propaganda for your campaign. You're not doing journalism. You're not like, it's like, who knows what the things that got left on the cutting room floor said. But as messaging, it was so powerful to hear those people.
I think that's part of it, though, because if you knew he was running, you would think this is another ambitious, self-interested politician doing this. So I'm going to take it with a grain of salt.
Totally. But it was completely disguised, right? The end is a reveal. I really thought it was like a journalist, I guess, or an influencer doing it. And then at the end, it's like, this is why I'm like, oh, wow. I was like, wow, that was clever.
there was this very online debate, as most of them are, after AOC won, where, you know, a lot of folks on the left said she mainly won because of her, you know, populist progressive agenda. And a lot of other people said, I think, you know, she won mainly because she's a generational talent.
Yeah, she's incredible.
And how she communicates and connects with people. I can feel this coming with Mamdani as well.
Yes.
But I also, like, I still feel this way. I felt this way then with AOC and I feel it now with Mamdani. There have been plenty other candidates with populist progressive agendas who just have not been as politically successful. And it just, it feels like these two are just special talents.
I totally agree that they are special talents. And I also think that everyone wants it to be the case always, right? That every victory shows why they're, you know, they're...
Confirms their priors, yeah.
Confirms their priors and also is the roadmap for their side in a factional dispute to emerge victorious. There's so much that's sui generis about that first AOC victory. But just to talk about Mamdani, because I've been closely following the race, I do think the affordability message is what has allowed him to transcend some of the ideological barriers that can pen in left-coded candidates.
I agree with that.
And I think he's been very smart and savvy. And I think starting that campaign by talking to working-class people of color in Fordham Road in the Bronx, talking about why they moved to Trump wasn't just propaganda, because I think it actually did animate what the campaign is centered, which is affordability.
And she did that too, by the way, in 18.
She did that too in 18. And I do think that if you look at those swings and you look at those precincts, working class folks were feeling the effects of inflation the hardest. And particularly in urban environments where rents were really squeezed. So I think it's both, right? It's the message and the messenger. But in Mamdani's case, I think that focus on affordability has been a very key part. And I think the one thing I'll say about focusing on affordability is, in his case, it's sort of left-coded. But it doesn't necessarily have to be. Like, you can have other solutions, you know, plausibly. But focusing on that has been a huge key to building the coalition he has.
It's funny, though. It's like there's so many other Democratic candidates who have clearly read the memos and the polling on affordability. Because it's, you know, it's left-coded, or at least the way that Mamdani has talked about it is. But this is one area where the mainstream Democratic consultants and the center-left would agree with folks on the left. And, like, everyone should be talking about affordability. But for some reason, when a lot more mainstream or moderate Democratic candidates do, it's not necessarily just the policies that might not be as appealing, because they don't really talk as much about the policies. But just the way they talk about affordability seems like they are just reading off the polling memo. This is my real problem. Like,
I totally agree. And this is a real question about, like, I don't know. Does it matter or does it not? I don't know. I want to say that it matters when you sound like a fluent human and not like someone reading off a sheet of paper. One of the things you always have to remember, right, about any organization that's doing things at scale is that the process has to be optimized for the bell curve of talent in any domain.
Yeah.
Like, you can't run any organization where it's like, we're going to do it in a way that's optimized for the top 10% of performers. Because by definition, you can't just have a top 10% of performers.
Right.
So the same is true of politics at some level, right? Like, it does have to be optimized for kind of the median candidate who's like, I am here to tell you that Donald Trump is tearing down the ballroom. That doesn't do anything to lower your costs, you know, like, and
I know,
because to do things at scale, that's kind of how things work. But I agree with you that it feels different when you see someone doing it intuitively and fluently than when you feel like you're watching the polling memo being read.
Yeah. And it's almost like too many median candidates right now. And not enough. Like, that top 10% is, you know, I don't, it's like a top 2%. I don't know. It's just not a,
you know, but I also do think, like, for instance, I think in Michigan, you have three pretty good candidates. They all have their, I think, their advantages. I think they're all pretty gifted politicians.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think this primary season can be very interesting because there's a lot of potential for races to be the, like, person with the traditional bio and not a great attention getter or maintainer or talker, and the person with the non-traditional bio who is good at that.
Yeah.
And I think we'll see those pitted against each other in primaries a fair amount. It'll be very interesting to watch how that plays out.
Well, let's talk about Plattner, because when I read your piece,
I haven't heard of him.
When I read your piece,
can someone pull the plug on the internet for a second? Graham Plattner discourse. I'm like, I can't. This is too much.
Which is, honestly, it's like why I waited this long in this interview. But when I read your piece, it was like Monday, and I reached out to you because I was like, I got to the part of it, your piece of advice where you said, don't worry so much about negative attention. And I'm like, we have a really interesting test case right now.
You sure do.
On negative attention. What are your thoughts on this whole, on the whole Plattner thing?
Let me first start with just my substantive thoughts on it, because I think it's worth, I mean, I did not know personally that the tattoo, when I saw it, was this fairly infamous Nazi symbol. Personally, I did not know.
Nor did I, no.
The context of I was drunk in a bar in Croatia and got this tat seems totally possible, and I don't have any reason to think he's lying. And that seems exculpatory. Does feel like if you do find out later, then you got to get that covered. And weird that you didn't.
Yes, unless you are, like he says he is, a person who thought, I'm never running for office. I'm not going to do politics. I'm just like a guy living in rural Maine. And I kind of embarrassed that I got this, but no one's saying anything to me about it.
Yeah.
And
every
time my shirt's off, no one's ever, and the army checked me when they, you know, like I could at least imagine, I'm not saying that that's what happened, but.
No, and agreed. And it doesn't, I think that connects to the original part about it, which is that, like, it's not so obviously legible as that, such that it's not having a swastika on your chest, right? So because it's not legible, then that rationale makes a little more sense. I still understand why people are skeeved out by it.
I understand why,
you know. So I'm not going to weigh in about, like, you know, this is disqualifying or not. I understand why people are skeeved out of it. I sort of understand the story, but sort of don't. The broader question now is, okay, A, substantively, if you're a voter, like, how do you feel about this and how do you feel about what he said? And, you know, or a donor, you can make up your mind about that. But now there's this real question. There's two questions. One is, does this hurt him in the primary? And the latest polling is like, he's up 30 points on Deanna Mills.
Which, honestly, that shocked, I mean, like, I didn't.
Shocked me.
I would have guessed that it would not have hurt him as much as the internet has been saying. I would never have guessed that the margin would be that big. And who knows? It's one poll, so we'll wait for others. But
right. So totally shocked by that. So now we come to this very interesting set of test cases of the things that I've been writing about, but also a kind of recurrence of what we saw happen on the right in the Tea Party primaries, right? The insurgent candidate closer to the base beating the hand-picked candidate by the party establishment, oftentimes to the detriment of winning the seat. The Delaware Senate seat being the most obvious one, in which Mike Castle, who had been the at-large congressional beloved moderate Republican, lost in a shocking primary upset to a woman named Christine O'Donnell. For the youngins here, it was a whole thing. Google it. She had to have an ad where she said, "I am not a witch." She got absolutely trounced in what would have been probably a very winnable race for Castle. And there were a whole bunch of candidates like that. People that were more extreme, but also looser and said all sorts of things and got a lot of negative attention, more polemical. The base loved that. They loved when they riled up the other side. They elected them in the primary. Then they ran the general and they got their butts kicked. And there's probably, you can probably count between 4 and 9 Senate seats that were winnable Senate seats over the course of 10, 12, 14, even if you look at Blake Masters and on and on. That Republicans have just gone with the person that the base liked because they told it like it is, and the median voter was like, no, thank you. And I don't know if that is what happens in Maine on both fronts. I don't know if it's very early in the race. Maybe people come around. I also don't know if, like, the attentional environment has changed such that backlash and the negative energy created by a Christine O'Donnell means you lose the race because people are like, who's this guy who's never held office and also has a Nazi tattoo and also maybe is a communist, as he said on Reddit. And like, this is a vetting nightmare for all the reasons that the person reviewing this would be like, please do not, we're not going to have you as a candidate. Or maybe the attention environment has changed so much, no one remembers that. And he is a very talented communicator. I mean, 100%. He's a super interesting dude. He's a good talker. His own politics might be closer to the median voter in a weird way than any Democratic like person I've seen in a long time, in the same way kind of, I mean, not in the same way, but in a kind of similar way to the way Trump is.
This is what I was thinking about when you were mentioning the Tea Party stuff, right? Because I think, and I think this is how a lot of the Democratic establishment is viewing this race. If you look at the race as Janet Mills is the mainstream Democratic electable governor that the whole state knows, and that Graham Plattner is this insurgent leftist that the base will like, but in the general, independents and even a few Republicans will be like, absolutely not, right? And I think if you look at it that way, then it is obvious that he shouldn't be the nominee and that she's the better bet. But I think the test for him and for other candidates potentially like this, and this is what happened with Trump as well, by the way, is like, is there a case that Graham Plattner could have a more appeal to unaffiliated voters, independent voters in Maine, which there are many? They just also have some just interesting, different kind of quirky politics in Maine. You know, and in that same poll, you know, Janet Mills' approval with independents is like sitting at 35%.
Yes. Which is a real issue too.
Which is a real issue too. And I'm like, that to me is what's interesting. And if he can't break into independents and Republicans and get some of those votes, then yes, the establishment is correct. But we are in a moment right now where I think for Democrats to win, not just in a fairly blue state like Maine, but especially in some of these redder states, we have to do something to scramble the coalitions because we're not going to get there just by winning the Democratic base and then like reaching out for a few independents here and there.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that scrambling is really interesting. And I think that I don't know where this all goes, but I also think it's kind of good that it's all happening. Like, maybe that's a cop-out, but I'm glad he got in the race. I'm glad the Oppo dump happened. Like, yes,
yeah.
Now is the time. Thank you. Not 2 weeks before the election. Not like, yes. Yes, this is what primary is for. Yes, maybe there's a million other things that come out, or he just falls on his face, or he just proves to be, like, incredibly adept candidate. Everyone go out there and make your case. And, you know, the other thing about all of this is I genuinely don't want to discount people being like, there's a lot of people who are like, a Nazi tattoo is disqualifying.
Right.
That's the full sentence. And I don't think that's at all a crazy instinct.
I don't either.
I want to be very clear. But I was thinking about like people were talking about like another Fetterman, right? I've seen this sort of trope of like that, you know, Fetterman was very much progressive. He was a big Bernie guy and he was elected and he's become a kind of, I would describe him as sort of like a McCain of the Democratic Party a little bit. Like
maybe even more like, I can't remember the last time that he's like sounded like a regular Democrat.
Yeah. I mean, what McCain was very good at, as you recall, is he had a few issues where he was very high profile at war with the Republican Party, but would vote with them like 95% of the time.
Right. But yeah.
The ACA thumbs down was such a departure from his usual MO, in fact, and really a remarkable one, he saved the ACA. But he figured out, this kind of space that was very good. I mean, the guy had incredibly high national approval ratings for much of his career because of this. And the reason I was thinking about Fetterman is like, I understand why people are appalled by some of the things Fetterman has said about what's happening in Gaza and said about Palestinians. I mean, some of the things he's said I found like really deeply, deeply gross and offensive. It's also the case that like, to the best that we can tell, his approval rating has increased in Pennsylvania.
Mostly because of Republicans.
Well, right, exactly, but that's the point.
Right, yeah. I think he's lost some with Democrats.
His overall net approval in Pennsylvania has gone
up. Yeah.
That's fairly clear. And it's like, right, having huge, high-profile, attention-getting fights with your own party is, particularly voters not paying a lot of attention, a signal of moderation.
Yeah.
Like, and that signal of moderation, that signal can be sent in many different ways. Bernie Sanders being a great example of someone who was an independent and in his rhetoric attacked Democrats and Republicans all the time and signaled to his voters that he was a moderate in some ways. Because of that, there are different ways to send these signals to a fairly checked out voter that you are not just like a down the line partisan or ideologue. And I understand why people who are down the line partisans and ideologues hate that. And no one is blaming you for hating it. But it's not like that is a crazy political approach to the median voter.
I always thought one of the silliest attacks from Hillary Clinton on Bernie in the 2016 primary was, well, you're not really a Democrat. I'm like, him not being really a Democrat is probably what attracts so many people to him. People don't like
Absolutely.
The Democratic Party. They don't like either party. You know, like people
right.
are just, it's they've been steadily disliking both parties for some time now. If you can,
totally.
Even if you're like a socialist from Vermont, if you can say you're an independent, that's helpful. It's better than saying
totally.
You're a socialist, I think.
Totally.
final question on this, because we've been talking about state races and House races. We're going to have another election in 2028, hopefully, for president. And I do think that trying to nominate a candidate, and again, and you mentioned this in the piece, that it is so obvious that it almost feels weird stating it, but like nominating a candidate who is extremely charismatic and can talk well and get attention, like it's got to be at the top of the list. And when you think about the last, okay, Hillary in 16... Biden in 20, Biden and then Kamala in 2024, like
yeah.
it has been, and you know, some have been better than others and fine at communicating, but like, and I think that Kamala Harris did a good job in her 107 days in communicating.
Yeah, I agree.
But we've talked about the sort of prevent defense and the risk aversion. I think that's just got to be at the top of the list.
Absolutely.
Like, I don't think like
yes.
your good resume and you're electable here and there, the other thing, like that's important too. But I do think that if you can't grab and keep someone's attention, I don't know how that person wins the presidency.
the inverse of the point I was making about local races is that it matters the most at the presidential level. Like, it matters the least at, like, you know, your school board, your city council. Like, you don't need to go viral. Attention at the national level is that is so important. And it is, like, strange when you take a step back and think there are all sorts of virtues as people or as politicians that the last three Democratic candidates had: Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, and Kamala Harris. And Joe Biden in 2020 was successful, and he won by 4.5 points. I don't think anyone would say, like, their biggest skill and the thing that sets them apart is how good they are at communicating. People did say that about Barack Obama and Bill Clinton.
And they said it about Donald Trump.
And they said about, like, they said about Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, like, that was the thing people said about them. Like, the number, there's a lot of other things they said about them, but kind of the defining thing. And I think some of that in our perception is gendered 100%, but I also think there are genuinely talented, incredibly talented communicators.
AOC is maybe one of the best in the party.
Probably the
top five.
Top five. So I take that seriously. I think it's real. But yeah, like, it is a little weird when you go back and think, right, like, that's kind of maybe necessary. And I do think, look, 2020 is different, and the combination of COVID and incumbency, and Biden had an unusually high level of name recognition. Like, there's all things that came together. But yes, I agree with you. Personally, I think that has to be at the top of the list.
We'll see. Because right now I look out at there, I'm like, okay, I don't know. People are doing a lot of talking about a lot of different people. And I'm like, I'm still waiting to see that. And of course, a campaign changes you, or at least, as Axelrod always says, reveals who you are.
Yep.
And people also grow during the course of a campaign and become better. So that could happen. But yeah, it is striking to me how little attention within the party is paid on, okay, if the person's going to win in 2028 and we're going to nominate them, they've got to be a really good communicator.
I'm just thinking, like, there are people that are really good communicators in, you know, again, there's a distribution here, you know, throughout the party, as there's going to always be. But I think that thinking in those terms is actually really important for everyone who's going to be along for this ride.
Yes, me too. Well, we'll leave it there. Chris, thank you, as always, for joining Offline. It's fun to have you.
That was fun.
All right, I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Thanks a lot.
Two quick notes. CrookedCon is 2 weeks from today. As you may have heard, a ton of new speakers were added to the November 7th lineup. Lena Khan, Adam Mockler, Tim Miller, Pramila Jayapal, Jen Psaki, Simone Sanders Townsend. Today we're sharing the full CrookedCon schedule. Here's a little preview of that. I'll be moderating a panel called What's the Story? It's about how we mobilize voters with a clear story about who we are, who we fight for, and what we'll do. I'll be joined by Jen Psaki, Faz Shakir, and Democratic strategist Liz Smith, Rebecca Katz, and Adam Jenelson. Vote Save America will also have an action hub that will come with its own set of programming, so stay tuned for more details on that. See the full schedule and be sure to grab tickets if you haven't already at crookedcon.com. There aren't many left. Also, if you haven't already, check out Alex Wagner's new podcast, Runaway Country, right here at Crooked Media. It is a fantastic show. First episode is already out, and it's doing really well. We're getting a lot of great feedback. In the show, Alex talks to voices at the center of the headlines, from the fringes of the resistance to the marrow of MAGA to the many people who found themselves smack dab in the middle of a fight they never asked for. Join Alex as she brings together the stories of everyday Americans trapped in our national car with no brakes, alongside conversations with some of the smartest thinkers in politics. Buckle up. The road could lead anywhere. Tune in to Runaway Country with Alex Wagner every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts, or subscribe on YouTube. As always, if you have comments, questions, or guest ideas, email us at offline@crooked.com. And if you're as opinionated as we are, please rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. For ad-free episodes of Offline and Pod Save America, exclusive content, and more, go to crooked.com/friends to subscribe on Supercast, Substack, YouTube, or Apple Podcasts. If you like watching your podcast, subscribe to the Offline with Jon Favreau YouTube channel. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and the other ones for original content, community events, and more. Offline is a Crooked Media production. It's written and hosted by me, Jon Favreau. It's produced by Emma Illich-Frank.
Austin Fisher is our senior producer. Adrian Hill is our head of news and politics. Jarek Centeno is our sound editor and engineer. Audio support from Kyle Seglin. Jordan Katz and Kenny Siegel take care of our music. Thanks to Delon Villanueva and our digital team who film and share our episodes as videos every week. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.